Chapter 14, The Business of Government. It can be readily appreciated that the business of government of Prince Edward Island has grown in such a manner that changes in the administration and very structure of government are absolutely necessary. Premier Alex Campbell, Policy Statement on Government Reorganization, June 24, 1970.
Having seen this project consummated by private enterprise, I'm so firmly convinced now that if the project had been undertaken by Public Works, it would never have been finished under the time and financial constraints that the public sector builder was able to achieve. It's just not the nature of a government agency or department to be able to play hard and fast with the business world. Alex Campbell, speaking to New Brunswick journalist Jacques Potras about the Confederation Bridge, June 1, 1998.
As an opposition MLA, Alex Campbell got an early taste of the preoccupations of PEI governments and of island voters. During province-wide meetings in the winter of 1966, and through a considerable volume of correspondence, Campbell heard from islanders looking to have their road paved or shaled, their teaching license upgraded, their pension looked into, or their daughter or son employed at the manor or on the highways. In 1967, an island high school student wrote to the premier with a special plea. "I wish to grow my hair to a length comparable to the Beatles. I would like to know if there's any rule of such that can prevent me from wearing my hair at the length I wish." The student had been told by his teachers to get his hair cut. As was his practice with all correspondents, Campbell responded, diplomatically recommending that the student do as his school required. While the annual expenditure by PEI's government had risen from $31 million in 1961 to $52 million by 1966, the business of government was still conducted in a very hands-on fashion, which Deputy Provincial Treasurer Doug Dennis describes as a personality kind of thing. Everybody knew everybody else. Even as government operations expanded and modernized, there remained an expectation that the Premier would have an open door and be attentive to the individual problems of islanders. Leonard Bradley, who was Campbell's principal secretary during his last 30 months as premier, says that Campbell was walking in two worlds, bringing in modernization while dealing with a constituency that was looking for an old Highland chief. People would go to see Campbell about personal problems, thinking, "I'd better go and see what the premier says about this." Bradley says that they were always received patiently and with great humanity. Upon taking office, Alex Campbell found that the most obvious place where government needed to modernize its practices was at Cabinet itself. Just about everything went to Executive Council. "As we began in government," recalls Campbell, "I found that the Cabinet agenda might have 25 or 30 items to be resolved on a given Thursday. There was very little in the way of advice or discussion coming up from the Civil Service to Cabinet, except perhaps a question, what to do about this or what to do about that, how to handle this or how to handle that." Campbell says that the Cabinet struggled on for a year or two, but that they were just becoming overwhelmed. When they got into the development plan with its negotiations and strategies, Campbell says, it almost swamped the boat. Just as there was little in the way of briefings or preparatory documents, Cabinet secrecy ruled the day when it came to disclosing the results of deliberations, or even what was being discussed. Doug Boylan, who would become clerk of the Executive Council in 1972, recalls, "The overriding rule was secrecy, even to the point of not having an agenda or a report after the fact."
The transition and the senior team.
As with any government coming into office after two terms in opposition, there was a transition, starting with a new team in the Premier's office and decisions about public service leadership. Overhanging the transition was the fact that there was no money. Doug Boylan, who was provincial archivist in 1966, recalls, "We didn't know from one two-week period to the next two-week period if the bank was going to cash our check." While the provincial public service had quadrupled from 315 permanent employees in 1951 to almost 1,300 in 1966, the ranks were still thin. Art McGuigan, the Deputy Minister of Justice, was also the principal legislative draftsperson and was known to work long hours. When McGuigan became ill in 1970, Attorney General Elmer Blanchard took over drafting. Both McGuigan and Blanchard died young. Lauren Mose, who would become Deputy Minister of Education in 1967, discovered that there was basically no organization. Every person in the department except the secretaries reported directly to the deputy. Prior to Walter Shaw, who retired as Deputy Minister of Agriculture before getting into politics, PEI premiers always had a second occupation and source of income. That changed with Alex Campbell, who worked famously long hours. Campbell was rarely at home for dinner until late in the evening, and weekend meetings or engagements were common. His arrival as premier signaled a generational shift for the PEI public service and in the premier's office. For the bureaucracy, the shift was gradual. From 1965 through 1968, the number of permanent public servants increased by only 24 positions. Deputy ministers from the previous administration all remained in their roles, with the first change coming in August 1967, when Malcolm Mackenzie resigned as Deputy Minister of Education and was replaced by Lauren Mose. By 1971, there were several further departures or changes for deputies who had served for decades, one of them a 42-year veteran of the civil service. The retention of deputy ministers from the Shaw government spoke to Alex Campbell's confidence in the professionalism of the senior public service. It also spoke to his good nature. He trusted people, and he didn't have much appetite for dismissals. During Campbell's time as premier, there was only one dismissal of a deputy minister. Campbell and John Maloney were on a trade mission to South America in late 1973 when they met Gordon Fairfield, who was senior trade officer at the Canadian Embassy in Buenos Aires. They hired Fairfield as deputy minister of development, but it turned out that he wasn't very well suited for the job. Doug Boylan says that after 2 years, Andy Wells finally gingered Alex up to fire Fairfield, noting that Campbell hated to let anyone go. Boylan and economic advisor Michael Lane were invited to join Campbell and Wells in the premier's office for the fateful meeting. Boylan recalls that after about 15 minutes of beating around the bush, Lane spoke up and said, "Mr. Fairfield, you may be wondering why the premier has asked you to come. I believe it is his intention to dismiss you." Boylan adds that it shouldn't have happened that way, but that, with Alex, we'd still be there. Lucky he didn't have to do it very often. Ironically, the other abrupt departure of a deputy minister during the Campbell years would be Michael Lane himself, who resigned as Deputy Minister of Health in the fall of 1977 after a disagreement with Health Minister Catherine Colbeck and the government over whether the closure of rural hospitals should be recommended in a health strategy paper to be distributed for public consultations. The rule of the day between Campbell and his deputy ministers was good-natured collaboration. Campbell's authority was firmly but gently exercised. Keith Warnell was a young deputy secretary to Treasury Board in the early 1970s and was expected to query budget presentations to Cabinet. Deputy Minister of Development Hector Horty was presenting plans for spending under the development plan. Warnell was raising questions, as Campbell wanted him to do, from a Treasury Board and finance perspective. After about 8 or 10 minutes, Horty looked down the table and said to Campbell, "How long do I have to put up with this?" Warnell says, "The Premier just smiled and didn't say anything." In effect, Campbell said, "Keep going." Warnell reflects that the nonverbal exchange told a lot about how Campbell operated, saying, "He always knew that he had the ace up his sleeve and that he held the cards." Campbell handled his ministers the same way. There were some strong personalities. Along with the diplomatic high-performers like Elmer Blanchard, Bruce Stewart, Bob Skuerman, Earl Hickey, or George Ferguson, there were people with their own style, such as Lorne Bunnell, Robert Campbell, Gilbert Clements, or John Maloney. Even though he was younger in age than most of his cabinet colleagues, Campbell was always in charge. Keith Warnell says, "He didn't have to rise or show his authority. They had tremendous respect for him. He had led them into power." Doug Dennis recalls, "At times the Premier could cut off conversations in Treasury Board or Cabinet if people were going too far off track. He could bring them back, pleasantly, of course."
The Premier's Office.
Campbell was supported by a small team of four in the Premier's Office, starting with Andy Wells as Private Secretary and John Mullally as Coordinator of Federal-Provincial Affairs, plus Secretaries Sherry Finley and Muriel Deacon. By 1978, it was still a four-person team of Leonard Bradley, Gordon Sage, Sherry Finley, and Ann Smith. In January 1969, Andy Wells was named Executive Assistant to the Premier, with expanded responsibilities as coordinator of federal-provincial relations, including implementation of the Comprehensive Development Plan. As executive assistant, Wells was the Premier's troubleshooter with departments, ensuring that directions were carried out and requests answered, in addition to being legislative liaison and policy coordinator. Wells wrote the majority of Campbell's speeches throughout the years in office, with Wayne McKinnon, Marlene Clark, and Leonard Bradley taking on the role at various stages. Campbell and Wells were an effective team. Doug Boylan recalls, "Alex was good at staying above the fray. That meant that Andy fought many of his battles." Wells took pride in being heard but not seen. When asked whether the deputies came to view him as their senior counterpart, Wells comments, "The people in the departments had to get to know me, deputies and sub-deputies. We had good relationships. We'd put things together and send it in to Alex. My role was to work through Alex. He was the premier. I didn't look for people to come to me." When asked whether Wells had authority over the deputy ministers as his right-hand man, Alex Campbell says, "Today it may be formalized or mandated. In Andy's time, it was more voluntary. I don't think Andy ever had a job description. He was an expediter who remained in the background." During Wells' absence from the Premier's office to work at the Council of Maritime Premiers in 1971-72, George Egan, a young Liberal activist from Yarmouth, Nova Scotia, stepped in as private secretary. When Wells departed in early 1976 to go to the Institute of Man and Resources, Leonard Bradley was hired as Campbell's principal secretary. Michael Lane was in the Premier's office for two stints as economic advisor, and Gordon Sage served as Campbell's private secretary from 1972 for the duration of the mandate. Sage looked after all appointments, dealt with constituency issues, and ensured that political feedback was diplomatically filtered. Throughout the period, the tone for the Premier's office was set by Campbell's good-natured personality and work ethic. Leonard Bradley recalls that visitors from other provinces would remark on how the PEI Premier's office seemed so orderly, so calm. According to Bradley, that quality reflected Campbell's influence, saying, "Alex had a way of inspiring people around him with his calm, balanced, positive approach. It started at the top. That's leadership of the very best kind."
Capacity building, recruiting talent.
Campbell recognized within months of taking office that the PEI bureaucracy lacked the capacity to prepare an economic development plan and negotiate it with the federal government. What's more, there was federal funding available under the FRED program to hire a provincial team of experts. The Economic Improvement Corporation was created during the 1967 legislative session. Del Gallagher started as Economic Development Officer in January of that year, with the knowledge that he would become General Manager of the EIC. Gallagher geared up quickly, hiring a team of economists, planners, public administrators, and other experts from across Canada and elsewhere. While the EIC would be in operation for less than 30 months, it was like a blitzkrieg. As a crown corporation with federal funding through the FRED program, the EIC was not fettered by civil service hiring or budgetary constraints. At its peak, the corporation would employ almost 200 people. In addition to helping plan and negotiate the development plan, the EIC housed a group of land planners and mapping and assessment experts who were building a land inventory that was foundational to the plan and essential to the modernization of PEI's property records and taxation systems. The Economic Improvement Corporation built a strong sense of camaraderie and professional enthusiasm. This was an era of wide-open career opportunity for policy experts and planners. New Brunswick, Nova Scotia, and Newfoundland were building regional development teams, as were other Canadian provinces. Between 1966 and 1975, the federal bureaucracy doubled in size to more than 250,000 employees. Universities were growing in leaps and bounds and hiring people with graduate degrees. There were international opportunities in development and public policy. For people with credentials in public administration, planning, and development, it was a seller's market. Against the backdrop of demand for talent nationally and internationally, Dale Gallagher cast his net widely, advertising in professional and popular publications and drawing on networks of contacts. He traveled to conduct interviews and hired people over the telephone. People were recruited from across Canada, as well as from Britain, the United States, Australia, and elsewhere. That so many of the EIC employees were from away became a bone of contention and the subject of sarcastic comment notably from the official opposition. There were regular questions in the legislature about their credentials and provenance. Alex Campbell recalls, "By the time the EIC was in place, we had a very ripe political discussion in the province about the employment of outsiders. In the legislature, there were calls for lists of who was being appointed and where they were born. It was probably one of the hottest issues in the early stages of gearing up for the development plan." Even after he left the legislature, former Premier Walter Shaw continued to express alarm over what he termed an overloaded bureaucracy, which he said, "Too often has persons from off the island running our affairs who have no experience in their part of the world, our part of the world, and, like as not, no interest in the island either." After the development plan was signed in March 1969, MLA Cyril Sinnott criticised the port development policy as having been dreamed up by some outside expert who never saw salt water until he got on the car ferry. Not everyone was as unwelcoming. Wayne Easter was a 20-year-old farmer in 1968. When asked about Alex Campbell's main achievements as Premier, Easter singles out the courage to recruit outside talent into the civil service, saying, "A lot of expertise came into the province, and those people were smart." Keith Warnell recalls his first presentation to Cabinet, following which Agriculture Minister Dan MacDonald came up to say how much he had enjoyed it. MacDonald then proceeded with a classic Prince Edward Island line of inquiry. MacDonald, "Your name's Warnell?" Response, "Yes, sir." MacDonald, "That's not an island name, is it?" Response, "Yes, sir, it's an island name." MacDonald, "Warnell?" Response, "Yes, sir, I was born in Sydney and later moved to Glace Bay." MacDonald, recognizing that Warnell was referring to his Cape Breton roots, responded with a hearty laugh, threw his amputated arm with its prosthetic hook around Warnell's shoulders, and welcomed him. Warnell says that he and MacDonald were the best of friends from that point forward. It probably didn't hurt that MacDonald had served in the Cape Breton Regiment during the Second World War. People recruited to PEI to work on policy development and planning during the 1960s valued the experience. Keith Warnell found the PEI team to be an incredible group of people to be associated with. Almost everyone, including the Premier, was young. There was a lot of energy and a lot of interesting ideas. Richard Higgins arrived at the EIC as a young economist in 1967 and later served as Deputy Minister of Development. Leonard Bradley first came to PEI in the 1960s as part of the team of federally employed land economists, mappers, and planners led by Charles Raymond. Bradley says, "We had a good time, and we got a lot of work done." Tom and Kirsten Connor moved to PEI from Corning, New York, and settled in the Vernon River area in 1968. Tom Connor had responded to an advertisement in a Cornell University magazine recruiting people to work in Montague at New Start, an experimental social services agency set up by the province and funded with federal manpower dollars. His initial contract was for 1 year, and they didn't expect to stay. Kirsten Connor, an irrepressible optimist with the double disability of being a newcomer with a thick accent from her native Denmark, says that it was an amazing, uplifting situation for PEI to have Alex Campbell as Premier. She says that it was like an explosion, and that Campbell's optimism, smile, and his whole way of ease really lifted everybody up. She says that they likely wouldn't have stayed on PEI if he hadn't been there and created that feeling. In 1970, Tom Connor left New Start, which was about to close down, and moved to the recently established Department of Development, where he became a senior manager and eventually deputy minister. Kirsten says, "With what was happening on PEI at the time, with the Premier at the center of it, I felt that things were going to just keep getting better and that this was the place we wanted to be." Kirsten Connor would be named as a member of the inaugural Advisory Committee on the Status of Women and later served on the Land Use Commission. The attention focused on the origins or accents of people recruited to EIC and other development and planning roles grated on Premier Campbell, as it did on the employees. In April 1967, opposition leader Walter Shaw put forward a 13-part written question in the legislature asking, among other things, whether the named employees were native Prince Edward Islanders, whether they were engaged at any time in political activities, whether they were familiar with conditions in PEI, its background and its people, and the intimate details associated with the services for which they were employed. One of the people asked about was Joseph Burgass, whose family name was misspelled in Shaw's written question, who had been recruited as assistant manager of industrial enterprises. Burgess responded to Shaw's questions with a 3-page letter addressed to Andy Wells, spelling out his extensive educational background and work experience, including 3 years as regional coordinator of ARDA programs for PEI from 1964 to 1967. Burgess noted, "Mr. W.R. Shaw and his cabinet, particularly Mr. MacPhail and Mr. Rossiter, should be aware of this, as over the last 3 years I have attended a great number of meetings with them and held a great many discussions, not only here but in Ottawa as well." Eugene Gorman, who had served as a deputy minister under the Shaw government and was originally hired into the provincial public service in 1947 by Shaw while he was deputy minister of agriculture, responded to the opposition leader's questions in a letter to Premier Campbell. Gorman closed with a question of his own. "Since my parents, in common with hundreds of thousands of others, found it necessary to go forth to the foreign province of Ontario to give me birth, thus depriving me of my right to claim to be a native son, am I considered to be less able, less trustworthy in undertaking the responsibilities set out for me?" Burgess's letter to Wells included the observation, "As a matter of interest, people in this field of development work are at a premium in Canada today, and it is a comparatively new field." In March 1970, Alex Campbell, partly out of curiosity and partly out of pique at the persistence of complaints about experts from away, asked for a review of the staff of EIC and the Department of Development to determine the proportion that were born on PEI. The analysis, with precise identification of the place of birth of each employee and the corresponding electoral district, showed that more than two-thirds of employees at both EIC and the Department of Development were island-born. The group of deputy ministers who served Campbell during his time as premier would mirror this demographic profile.
Reorganizing government.
In 1968-69, the province commissioned a comprehensive review of its bureaucratic organization and practices. The study was carried out by a Chicago-based group of public administration consultants with a mandate to put in place a modern personnel system and to strengthen government's administrative structure and management processes. On the consultants' advice, the province adopted a new system of classification and compensation for civil service positions, plus processes to set competitive salaries, to recruit and select qualified personnel, and to provide ongoing staff training and development. The consultants also identified the need for a more logical organization of government departments and a more structured approach to the work of executive council. In the legislative session following the 1970 election, Premier Campbell presented a policy statement on government reorganization, unveiling a series of structural and administrative reforms, the centerpiece of which was a transformation of the way Executive Council did business. Treasury Board would be reconstituted and an Executive Council Secretariat established. Along with a new Office of Planning and Development, these units would ensure that Cabinet operated with a well-planned agenda and that decisions were clear. Campbell announced that henceforth all matters coming to Cabinet would in the normal course be previously considered by one of two Cabinet committees, one focused on finances and one on policy development. These structures mirrored those in other jurisdictions. Setting up all the procedure and structure on how Cabinet operated was one of the most interesting things that I did in government, recalls Doug Boylan. I spent 3 weeks on the road in Ottawa, Toronto, and Saskatchewan looking at how they served Cabinet. We took what they did and adapted it to PEI. It served us very well. When Dan MacDonald became a federal cabinet minister in 1972, he was impressed to find that things worked pretty much the same way in Ottawa as they did in Charlottetown. The 1970 policy statement announced changes to the organization of government departments. Premier Campbell rebutted suggestions that Prince Edward Island could be governed by as few as 5 bureaucratic departments, saying that such proposals are usually associated with some troubled concern over the fact that Prince Edward Island is a province rather than a satrapy. He announced an immediate reduction in the number of departments from 15 to 12, with the leading changes being the creation of new consolidated departments of labor, industry, and commerce, and of community services. Other reforms included amalgamating public works and highways into a single department, as well as agriculture and forestry. With all areas of government engaged in a flurry of activity to implement the development plan, Campbell was not looking to introduce too many innovations at once. The question of how the development plan should be coordinated and managed for government as a whole, while line departments took responsibility for programs in their areas, lay at the heart of the 1970 reorganization. The Department of Development would be the coordinating agency, reporting to the Premier, and the Deputy Minister of Development would serve as the provincial plan manager. Premier Campbell served as co-chair of the Joint Advisory Board and as chair of the Planning Board, a body of ministers, deputies, and officials that met weekly to coordinate and strategize development plan programs and spending from a provincial perspective. Campbell rarely missed a Planning Board meeting and was present for all meetings of the Joint Advisory Board. He was known for doing his homework on everything from manpower programs to fire service to farm subsidies to industrial development, while listening attentively to departmental experts and leaving them to do their jobs. When the Joint Advisory Board was being established, Deputy Minister of Development Hector Horty argued in a January 1970 memo to Campbell that PEI should name senior civil servants to the board, as the federal government had done. Horty contended that by appointing bureaucrats rather than cabinet ministers, this would leave cabinet the greatest possible flexibility to accept or reject JAB recommendations. Horty's memo further submitted that by appointing civil servants, the Joint Advisory Board's status would be downgraded, thereby undercutting perceptions that civil servants were running the province. The arguments did not prevail with Campbell. He and senior cabinet ministers sat on the Joint Advisory Board and played an active role in policy-making and strategy, with support from senior civil servants. Consistent with the advice of the 1968 consultant study, the 1970 policy statement envisaged a gradual decentralization of the comprehensive development plan management to the line departments, or to central agencies such as the Department of Finance, Treasury Board, or the newly created Executive Council Secretariat. In the policy statement, Campbell said that it was intended that the work of the Department of Development would be completed within 3 years, and optimistically reported that the process was running ahead of schedule. While it would be gradually reduced in size and influence, the Department of Development remained in place throughout Campbell's years in office, to be eliminated in 1980 by the Angus MacLean administration. Tom Connor, who became Deputy Minister of Development in 1976 and was involved in plan coordination starting in 1970, believes the Department of Development was needed because the devil was in the details. Connor says that plan-funded programs had to fit within a framework of rules laid out in a federal-provincial agreement. Throughout the life of the development plan, there were debates and elaborate scenarios about what could or could not be done with federal-provincial funds. Finance Minister Earl Hickey was famous for querying program proposals to determine whether they could be cost-shared or had to be done entirely with provincial money, in which case they were less likely to gain approval. Federal-provincial negotiations over development plan funding and contributions continued well into Campbell's third term. Phase 2 was not signed off until October 23, 1975, and the federal government was only prepared to commit to 2 years of funding. Going into 1978, the two sides were involved in tough negotiations for the remaining years, notably over whether the federal government would continue contributing toward the salaries of approximately 200 provincial public servants who had been hired with shared funding to implement development plan programs. On a Friday evening in January 1978, John Maloney and Tom Connor were on a conference call with Doug Love, Deputy Minister of DRE. Connor says the federal bureaucrats were stuck on not continuing with the staff overhead, while we were arguing that you can't do the job without people. After some time, the two sides agreed that they needed to consult with their principals. Alex Campbell had retreated to his cottage in Stanley Bridge, where he did not have a telephone. Maloney contacted him through a neighbor, and Campbell invited them to come out, but cautioned that they could not drive to the cottage due to an accumulation of snow. Campbell met Maloney and Connor on his snowmobile and brought them into the cottage across the frozen river, all three of them traveling on a single snowmobile. After a one-hour discussion, Campbell and Maloney concluded that the province would have to concede to the federal view and start laying off staff. Upon their return to Charlottetown, Maloney and Connor got on the phone to Love, who informed them that he had met with DRE Minister Marcel Lessard and Deputy Minister of Finance Tommy Shyama, who had agreed that we can go ahead and fund the salaries for another couple of years. Maloney, who was on the verge of conceding that the province would make the cuts, offered a hasty, Okay, we'll take it. The incident illustrates the evolving and tentative character of the Comprehensive Development Plan almost 10 years after it was signed, and the active and strategic role retained by Alex Campbell.
Public service growth and development.
Throughout the Campbell years, there were sensitivities and criticisms about the size of the public service. As early as 1968, The Guardian ran an editorial under the title, "Tale of Bureaucracy Wags the Government Dog," complaining, "The welfare state created by socialism makes necessary a great deal of paperwork, even in the preparation of the checks which distribute the state's bounty." In September 1968, the Financial Times ran a speculative report about development plan negotiations, suggesting that under the plan, the provincial public service would be cut nearly in half and the number of government departments reduced. The Financial Times article, which appeared to be based on federal sources involved in plan negotiations, otherwise had an air of plausibility, such as a prediction that school administration would be consolidated into about 5 boards instead of the former 371. Alex Campbell was in Ottawa negotiating with the federal government when the Financial Times report appeared, and Elmer Blanchard, who was acting premier, issued a speedy press release denying that any public servants would be dismissed. Del Gallagher spoke up as general manager of the Economic Improvement Corporation to denounce the report as dangerously misleading and complain, "It produces unnecessary anxiety among the employees of the provincial government and distorts the aim and intent of the development program." While The Guardian gave prominent coverage to the denials and said that it was reassuring that government reorganization will mean the creation of a whole new range of opportunities in these departments, it protested in an editorial that the provincial government had only itself to blame, as the secrecy surrounding federal-provincial negotiations has put a premium on rumors of all kinds. The Financial Times' prediction of public service reductions under the development plan turned out to be false. Prince Edward Island's permanent public service almost doubled between 1966 and 1978, from 1,276 classified employees to almost 2,400, with all of the growth occurring between 1969 and 1975. This growth spurt included bringing employees from the Economic Improvement Corporation into government, and the classification of employees who were previously full-time casual. There was more modest growth in seasonal, part-time, and temporary employees, from approximately 1,000 in the final years of the Shaw government to 1,100 in Alex Campbell's later years. What changed more dramatically than the number of public servants during the Campbell years were their salaries, benefits, and working conditions, including job security and pensions. Provincial public sector unions were just coming on the scene in the late 1960s. Liquor store employees were the first civil servants to organize. They were followed by teachers, nurses, bus drivers, and non-teaching personnel in the school system, with the general group of provincial public servants organized through the Public Service Association. Campbell was in favor of these developments, as he believed that they were integral to a modern public service, including the need for salaries to be competitive. Keith Warnell was involved in negotiations throughout this period as a Treasury Board representative. He says that it gradually became more of a professional, analytical approach on both sides of the table, as opposed to a haphazard or at-whim process. Warnell says that this was a quantum jump compared with the former system of people sitting around a table setting pay raises on an individual basis. In 1972, following extensive study by a cabinet committee on public service bargaining, and at the request of nurses, teachers, and the Public Service Association, the three largest employee groups, Prince Edward Island embraced binding arbitration as the ultimate mechanism to settle contracts. The model provided for a four-stage process: consultation, negotiation, conciliation, and if necessary, binding arbitration. This was selected after an extensive review of public sector bargaining experience across Canada and internationally, which Labour Minister Bruce Stewart presented to the annual Premier's meeting in Halifax in August 1972. The study reasoned that the community did not have an appetite for public sector strikes, and that employee bargaining groups were not subject to the same discipline that pertained in the private sector. While the PEI model called for wages comparable to those of better-paid employees in the private sector, the ultimate comparison was with public servants in neighbouring provinces, with the Prince Edward Island government's objective being to pay between 85 and 90% of the Atlantic average. The financial gains for public servants were dramatic and palpable throughout the ranks. In 1975, government released the names and salaries of 230 senior public servants with salaries higher than $18,000, indicating in response to questions in the legislature that this compared with 14 civil servants who were paid at that level in 1970. Teachers saw their paychecks grow by leaps and bounds, sometimes with two increases per year in the later 1960s, as they improved on a 1966 median salary of less than $3,000. The challenges were compounded by accelerating inflation beginning in the mid-1970s and by the strictures of national wage and price control programs. By 1978, the total annual pay of PEI civil servants approached $45 million. The cumulative salaries of municipal, provincial, and federal employees on Prince Edward Island, plus teachers and professors, added up to $117 million, representing 21% of income from all occupations. This compared with about 10% nationally. By the mid-1970s, there was growing concern about the size and cost of the public service on Prince Edward Island and nationally. A 1973 economic overview prepared by the PEI government found that provincial government employment had grown more than 50% between 1966 and 1971. In a 1975 editorial, the Evening Patriot cited an estimate that the number of provincial public servants in Canada had increased by 6.9% annually between 1961 and 1973. The editorial called on the PEI government to reduce the size and cost of the public service by not replacing those who retired or otherwise left their posts. Finance Minister Earl Hickey's 1975 budget projected an operating deficit of $2.8 million, the first in 6 years. While Hickey increased taxes on cigarettes and warned that higher taxes on alcohol were not far behind, his main message was to call for government to exercise restraint, notably through the curtailment of growth in the public service. The size of the public sector had become a preoccupation of all Canadian governments, with the 1978 First Minister's Conference on the Economy agreeing to create a federal-provincial task force to study government regulations. Prime Minister Trudeau told the conference, "Our aim must be to constrain the growth of our governments. We must reduce our share of the gross national product. But even more important, we must reduce the intrusion of bureaucracy in the daily lives of Canadians." On PEI, the number of permanent civil service positions declined by 2% between 1975 and 1978, as government implemented a no-growth policy. On the eve of the 1978 election, Finance Minister Bennett Campbell protested that the policy was not about cutting waste and that the PEI public service was equal to or better than any other in Canada. James Brady, Executive Director of the Public Service Association, said that bureaucracy was caused by a profusion of legislation and regulations, not civil servants, and that the public should be willing to pay higher taxes to match increased service demands. With an election pending, opposition leader Angus MacLean was cagey, commenting that the public service growth must be contained as long as it is done in a selective way. MacLean preferred to focus his criticism on the federal civil servants and the Comprehensive Development Plan, saying of the Joint Advisory Board, "They seem to believe government has to impose its will on people, to do things for people rather than create a framework where they can do things for themselves." Notwithstanding the positioning by various official players, the appetite for government jobs was strong. In West Prince County, the Civil Service Commission received over 130 applications in response to a handful of openings for liquor store clerks. Civil service training and professional development were priorities under the Comprehensive Development Plan and throughout the 1970s. A program of certificate and diploma programs in public administration offered through UPEI was popular, as were other opportunities to obtain new credentials. In 1977, more than 400 civil servants took advantage of tuition reimbursement and course subsidization programs, and each year as many as 20 employees took educational leave. The greatest volume of professional development activity occurred through in-service training programs organized by the Civil Service Commission, with short courses in everything from report writing to audio-visual familiarization to pre-retirement planning to stepping up to supervisor. In 1978, More than 1,300 employees took advantage of in-service programs, including a popular new offering, Serving the Public.
Public engagement.
While Alex Campbell's appetite to connect with people was at the core of his political success, his government was frequently criticized for perceived failings in public engagement. At the March 1969 signing of the Comprehensive Development Plan, Campbell stressed that this was a plan by the people, of the people, and for the people. He realized that this would be a difficult goal to attain. Development plan negotiations had already been labeled as secretive by the opposition and some media. A first order of business upon signing the development plan was to beef up the communications effort. Given the plan's long gestation period and the fact that Prince Edward Island and federal governments were themselves unsure of the details until the negotiations were complete, there was an understandable hunger on the part of islanders, community organizations, and the opposition conservatives for more information. One of the best moves on the communications front was to mail out a copy of the text of the Development Plan Agreement, complete with schedules and appendices, to every home on PEI. People were impressed to see how simple the 52-page document was, and to actually hold it in their hands, even if the bureaucratic language did not warm the cockles of all island hearts, as Alex Campbell had wished. Whatever the tactile benefit of having the agreement in their hands or on their shelves, it is doubtful that many islanders actually read the document. At the annual convention of PEI Young Liberals in early March 1970, only 6 delegates out of 150 indicated when asked for a show of hands that they had actually read the text. One of the government's worst moves in communicating with islanders about the development plan was to continue an EIC contract with broadcaster Kingsley Brown Jr. to head a planned communications effort. When the EIC wound down, Brown became head of a new communications branch in the Department of Development. The broadcaster cut quite a figure on PEI, notably by traveling around in his own plane. No stranger to an opinion, Brown was more of a porte-parole than a backroom spin doctor, and his views were not necessarily those of the government. He told the annual meeting of the PEI Federation of Municipalities, in a 9-page speech read by candlelight when the power went out at the Kirkwood Motel, that Atlantic Canada required a democratic revolution in thinking in order to be brought into the 20th century. Further, he said that on Prince Edward Island, we are going to have to prepare for a very radical change, and the ideas, the cooperative spirit, the integrity of mind and spirit, the assault against spiritual emptiness and intellectual bankruptcy will have to be a part of the new social awareness in every community. Brown was reported as having told a group of UPEI students, "We have the worst newspapers in the country and Yow Yow radio stations. Little wonder islanders are intellectually asleep." He subsequently clarified the comment by saying that he had referred to newspapers and radio stations in the Maritime region, not just PEI. By late 1969, the development plan communications effort was further behind than it had been in March. An editorial in the liberal-leaning Evening Patriot called for the government to talk with the people rather than to the people, and for a dialogue style of communication, concluding, "So if we abandon the public podium and sit around a table and all learn about the ramifications and possibilities and opportunities of the plan together, it should be considerably quicker in transfer from dream stuff to something that we can see, touch, watch, and hear in operation." Communications were even problematic at senior levels of the PEI public service, with John Eldon Green reporting that there was a lot of sensitivity in the air in late 1969 and early 1970 about experts from away taking over government. Kingsley Brown's contract was not renewed after the first year. In his June 1970 policy statement, Premier Campbell announced a number of new measures aimed at engaging the public service and encouraging broader public participation. He laid out the objective that all staff should feel involved in the attainment of departmental objectives and in future planning for the realization of goals, and called for departments to establish active planning units. For the community as a whole, Campbell emphasized that effective government required citizen involvement. He announced the creation of the Island Information Service within the Department of Development, and unveiled a contract with the Rural Development Council that was expected to be a major new factor in bringing about public participation. The Rural Development Council, or RDC as it was known, was established in the mid-1960s on the initiative of community-oriented clergy and social activists. It attained early success with a leadership role in community schools and involvement with the cooperative movement. The council became involved with the Economic Improvement Corporation and in 1968 contracted to facilitate public participation. The 1970 arrangement unveiled by Premier Campbell was a 5-year contract to conduct counseling and community development programs. By 1973, the RDC grew to a staff of more than 20 with an annual budget of $350,000. RDC officers worked with communities to develop local capacity, such as to establish community improvement councils and to interface with government. The RDC had to tread a narrow path between encouraging public input and being perceived to speak for or mobilize opposition. RDC employee John Kane's work in facilitating community response to the proposed national park in Eastern Kings offered a prime example of the function served by the council. The initiatives of other RDC officers, such as in debates about school consolidations or closures, caused complaints from backbench MLAs who considered it their job to relay constituents' views to the Premier and Cabinet. An evaluation under Phase 1 of the Comprehensive Development Plan identified 12 different departments, agencies, and organizations involved in offering public participation programs, and commented, "Where participation was a relatively minor element in island affairs in 1969, it is now a growth industry." For example, the Leadership Institute offered seminars, workshops, and meetings to community groups with a total attendance of more than 15,000 between 1969 and 1973, notably to leaders of youth organizations. The development plan evaluation recommended better coordination of public participation programs so that the various players will not be stumbling over each other and working at cross purposes. The tipping point between government and the RDC came with the latter's 1975 cabinet submission requesting a 5-year contract renewal, in which the RDC argued for additional funding and staff by contending, "There is a government program for almost every problem, although there is little, if any, local control of programs, and government is viewed as a system unto itself." The RDC's submission and its concerns about growing government involvement in all parts of island life were reported in front-page headlines on the afternoon of the cabinet presentation, under the banner, "Growing Government Draws RDC Criticism." This proved too much for Minister of Development John Maloney, who recommended against renewing the RDC's contract and remained unmoved by public and private protestations. Those looking for insight into Alex Campbell's views on the decision not to continue funding for the RDC, or to understand his 1969 move to close down the Economic Improvement Corporation in favor of creating the Department of Development, could find his philosophical outlook well articulated in the 1970 policy statement on government reorganization. In a section dedicated to public participation, Campbell fully embraced the need for an engaged public and well-informed government, while cautioning that public involvement in the decision-making process should not be confused with abdication of government's ultimate responsibility for making decisions. Although Campbell was anxious to search broadly for counsel and seek all possible sources of information, he was clear that it was for Cabinet, accountable to the Legislative Assembly, to set priorities, assess competing demands, and assess the ability and willingness of taxpayers to finance the range of services requested by various groups. Campbell emphasized, "Consultation, participation, public involvement, all of these are tools of decision. They are not decision." In August 1975, Campbell made an articulate plea for greater public participation in debates about public spending and long-term fiscal planning. He lamented to a Rotary Club audience that there had been so little public debate about public expenditures and financial strategies, and pledged to improve the flow of information concerning the issues, both major and minor, which we as a province must tackle. Campbell called on the media to do more homework, saying, "When I look at the hue and cry raised about the proposed $2 entry fee to the national park, and the $3 car tax, along with the almost hysterical response of some of the media, and compare that public comment to the virtual silence surrounding such policy questions as the submarine cable, $36 million, potential partnership in the New Brunswick nuclear power plant, $35 million, and the Central Referral Hospital, $29 million, I cannot help but be concerned. Campbell reiterated his philosophical commitment and sense of frustration regarding public participation and debate.
I suppose some forms of government would be thankful for the apparent unconcern the general public and the media have about such major questions. After all, the less public discussion, the easier it may be to govern. However, my concern is that we are making decisions involving not only a heavy expenditure of current revenues, but also revenues which must be raised by our children and grandchildren. It is important, if not essential, for the public to understand the implications of these policy questions and comment upon them.
Institutional reform and innovation.
Throughout the 12-plus years that Alex Campbell was in office, there was an ongoing search for new mechanisms or modes of government. This resulted in some failed experiments and in some initiatives that would have longer learning curves than initially expected. But from the beginning of Campbell's mandate to his final months in office, there was a willingness to try. In the near public sector, there was an early start with the establishment of the PEI Addictions Foundation and support for consolidation of credit unions and dairies. The 1967 legislative session produced a new Labor Relations Board and the Economic Improvement Corporation, plus legislation to enable the establishment of community improvement councils, a new and modest form of local government aimed at rural areas. While the community improvement councils lacked the capacity to play an effective role in planning, they filled a gap created by the elimination of local school districts and laid the basis for provision of services such as fire protection. The 1968 and 1969 legislative sessions saw the creation of the University of Prince Edward Island and Holland College, along with the establishment or upgrading of key development agencies such as the PEI Housing Authority, the Lending Authority, and the Land Development Corporation. Not all of the changes were institutional. Some of the greatest improvements came through administrative reforms, such as the selection and introduction of computer systems, starting in 1971 with a report from a multi-stakeholder computer selection committee. The 1970s brought substantial reforms in the administration of justice, including the creation of a Provincial Law Reform Commission, the Human Rights Commission, and the Office of the Rentalsman. The centerpiece of justice reforms was a comprehensive overhaul of the courts and supporting institutions following the advice of the 1973 McKimmey Report. This led to the abolition of county courts and justices of the peace, the reform of the PEI Supreme Court, the establishment of legal aid, the introduction of new rules of practice and procedure, and the construction of new court and jail facilities. McKimmey's most far-reaching recommendation, calling for the establishment of a Maritime Provinces Court of Appeal, was not implemented. In 1976, Alex Campbell faced an ethical challenge as Prince Edward Island considered jumping on the bandwagon of regulating lotteries, an issue brought to the fore by the popular lottery that provided funds for the 1976 Olympic Games in Montreal. Campbell discovered that a myriad of lottery and gambling initiatives, both private and community, made the lottery sector difficult to police, at the same time as we'd receive calls from mothers and spouses who went without the weekly paycheck. In the face of considerable opposition, including from the minister in his home church, Campbell concluded that Prince Edward Island had no choice but to join the crowd and create the PEI Lottery Commission, soon to evolve into the Atlantic Lottery Corporation. After the mid-1970s, there were numerous regional collaborations and innovations aimed at energy and environment, such as the establishment of the Institute of Man and Resources or the creation of the PEI Energy Corporation during Campbell's final legislative session in June and July of 1978. This legislative session also saw fundamental reform of family law with the new Family Law Reform Act.
Politics and government.
Alex Campbell's openness to innovation in the business of government stemmed mainly from his instincts as a politician. In policy debates, he would regularly come back to questions such as, "What difference will that make for people?" or, "Who would be interested in that?" Ultimately, the question was, "Who would vote for that?" One major reform on which Campbell's government took a pass was a 1974 report from a legislative subcommittee that reviewed PEI's electoral system. The main impetus for the review was disproportionate per capita voting power between urban and rural areas, plus a growing sense that dual-member electoral districts were dubious historical artifacts. The subcommittee recommended the creation of 30 single-member ridings and redistribution to better approximate one person, one vote. But both Liberals and Conservatives opted to let the moment pass. Campbell says that he was personally prepared to proceed with the changes, but the proposal received a summary rejection when it was brought to caucus. With both Liberals and Conservatives hesitant, if not outright resistant, and with an election not too far in the offing, it would be 20 years before electoral reform returned to the front burner of public policy on Prince Edward Island. On the more pervasive question of political patronage, it wasn't hard for Campbell to look like a reformer after the excesses of the first king's deferred election that brought him to power. If there was a lesson to be learned from that contest, it was that the votes of Prince Edward Islanders were not for sale. The traditional role of patronage declined during the Campbell years. While the offering of Election Day treats diminished, the practice was not completely eliminated. Following George Mackay's iconoclastic stand in 1962, the next breakthrough was an all-party agreement not to offer treats in the Cardigan riding during the 1968 federal election. In the 1978 provincial election, the Liberals' provincial organization had a no-treats policy, although this was not necessarily adhered to in all the districts. A more fundamental change saw the introduction of regular tendering practices for construction contracts, to the disappointment of prominent Liberal supporters who felt it was their turn. Politics continued to be a factor in the allocation of highways work among electoral districts, and especially in the hiring of casual employees. It would take longer, and the combined pressures of fiscal austerity and maritime cooperation, before government supply contracts became subject to regular bidding processes. While there were occasional accusations of favoritism, and a 1978 national study concluded that there were elements of patronage in the civil service of all 10 provinces, Alex Campbell's time in office saw a marked reduction in the role of patronage in hiring. Still, it depended on who you asked. Andy Wells had no use for patronage. Longtime MLA Arthur MacDonald believed it was not possible to get rid of it. Nonetheless, MacDonald cautioned from experience that doing favors can hurt you just as much as it helps you, especially in a weak economy. Alex Campbell was thankful that he had George Ferguson and Earl Hickey in cabinet. Hickey sat on Liberal Party committees dealing with fundraising, meaning that it was possible for Campbell to remain completely above the fray. Campbell recalls a cabinet meeting not long after the 1966 election when someone asked for the list of party donors. Earl was very indignant. That was politics. Those around the policy-making table were not to be privy to the financial affairs of the party. Campbell says that Ferguson was the consummate diplomat in the critical highways portfolio. All the Premier had to do was arrange for those with special pleas to see George. After the 1974 election, Ferguson was replaced by the equally judicious Bruce Stewart. It is telling about Alex Campbell's character and leadership that, while there were occasional short-lived ripples about political favoritism, he served for more than 12 years as Premier without a significant scandal. It was further telling that the most consistent rap from the opposition was that the Campbell government hired too many outsiders.
Personal example.
With all of the reforms and capacity building that changed how government did business during the years that Alex Campbell served as Premier, his greatest influence was his personal impact and example. Doug Dennis, who served as Deputy Minister of Finance during Campbell's years and in various senior roles in the PEI bureaucracy over the course of almost four decades, says with meaning, "More than anyone else that I worked for, I felt a personal sense of duty to Alex. I always felt a sense of, what can I do for you, rather than, what would you like me to do? Alex seemed to have that effect on a lot of people. He certainly did on me."